This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer Deborah Eisenberg, whose new collection of short stories, Transactions in a Foreign Currency, was described in the New York Times as an astonishing debut. Four of the stories in Transactions in a Foreign Currency were originally published in the New Yorker magazine. Several of the stories are about women who have temporarily lost their bearings because of disorienting changes in their lives, ranging from the breakup of a relationship to giving up smoking. Eisenberg, who is now 40, says that she didn't have a clue that she could write until she was in her 30s. She made her living as a secretary, then as a waitress. A few years ago, when her first story was staged as a monologue, producer Joseph Papp heard it and commissioned her to write a play. The result was Pastoral, which inspired New York Times theater critic Frank Rich to describe her as the most original comic voice to be heard in a New York theater in several seasons. Deborah Eisenberg lives in New York with her longtime companion, writer and actor Wallace Shawn, who affectionately refers to her several times in his film My Dinner with Andre. The film ends with Shawn saying, "When I finally came in, Debbie was home from work, and I told her everything about my dinner with Andre." When I spoke with Deborah Eisenberg, I asked her to read the opening of her story Flotsam from her book Transactions in a Foreign Currency, published by Knopf.
The other evening, I was having a drink with a friend when the sight of two women at the next table caused me to stop speaking in mid-sentence. Both of the women were very young and fashionable to an almost painful degree. They were drinking beer straight from the bottle, and they radiated a self-conscious, helpless daring, as if they had been made to enter some baffling contest and all eyes were upon them. "Earth to Charlotte," my friend said. "Everything all right?" "Fine," I said, and it was, but for a moment that seemed endless, I had been pulled down into a forgotten period of my life, when I, too, had strained to adhere to the slippery requirements of distant authorities. I'd just come to New York then, after breaking up with a man named Robert. At first, everything had gone well with Robert. We lived in Buffalo, on the ground floor of a large house, and while he taught at a local university and read and worked on his dissertation in the study, I tried to make things grow in our little patch of a garden and did some part-time research for a professor of political science. At night, we cooked dinner together or with other couples from Robert's department, or once in a while we went dancing or to a movie, and I thought Robert was happy. But after a while, Robert seemed to lose interest in me, and part of what I had been was torn from me as he pulled away. And the further he pulled away from me, increasingly the only thing I cared about was that he loved me, and there was nothing I would not have done to be right for him. But although I tried and tried to figure out how I ought to be, my means for judging such a thing seemed to have split off with him. So while Robert seemed to grow finer and more fastidious, easily annoyed by things I said or did, I seemed to grow coarser and more unfocused, and even my athletic tallness, which Robert had admired when we met, with the dissolving of his affection came to feel like an untended sprawl, and my long blonde hair, which I'd been proud of at one time, seemed insipid and childish, just another manifestation of how unequal to Robert I had proved to be. And after a time, I was overtaken by a paralysis that spread through every area of my life, rapidly, like an illness.
And that's the opening of Flotsam, the opening story from Deborah Eisenberg's new collection, Transactions in a Foreign Currency. Was that story inspired by a memory of yours?
Well, you know, the odd thing is I don't know. I don't think so. I don't really know where that story came from, but it has the feeling of a memory to me, but it isn't really a memory.
For a writer of such talent, you spent so much time not writing. Did you suspect on any level that you were a writer?
Oh, desperately not. I mean, I spent so much time insisting that I wasn't a writer, knowing that I couldn't be a writer, because only writers are writers. So therefore, it was obvious to me that I wasn't a writer.
What were you protesting against? Was anyone arguing that you were a writer?
Well, I guess all my life, various people who were always trying to figure out what on earth I was there for would say from time to time, "Well, why aren't you writing? You should be writing." But of course, I really think it was that all of my very powerful experiences as a child had been reading experiences. And I do, you know, when I began to write, retroactively, of course, it all seemed very clear to me because I had very intense memories suddenly of reading as a child and thinking, my God, this is magic. Who can do this? Who can make anyone feel the way I feel when I'm reading this?
Did you feel that something was missing in your life?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't feel anything was actually missing in my life. I just felt that something was missing for me. I felt that I was missing sort of a crucial girder somewhere. I was just a sort of faulty construction. And, you know, I was just sort of condemned to sort of spend my entire life half-built in a way.
When was the first time that you sat down and you wrote fiction or wrote something that wasn't a letter, that wasn't, you know, functional on some other part of your life?
Well, really, I was over 30, and there are a few steps that are almost too amorphous or obscure to even be traced, but basically under the vehement urgings of my boyfriend and out of complete desperation in my life, I did start to write something that turned into my first story, although it took me years before I knew it was a story.
What was it initially?
I actually thought that I was writing a factual piece about the YMCA, and it seems preposterous to me now, but it is the only story in this collection that is at all autobiographical, and it is, and it's because it just started out on that basis.
So you realized it was a story, and it took you years, you said, to
literally
actually
years.
Make it into a story. What did you do to it over those years? Were you changing the character, rewriting sentences, finding new verbs? What were you doing?
Well, partly, I suppose, I was just admitting to myself that I was doing it. And at first, I thought I was keeping a journal. And then, when I finally decided that I was writing something, I wrote it in the past tense. And then, when it became completely apparent that it was completely terrible, which the journal, as a sort of false journal, a sort of confected journal, it had not been so terrible, I turned it back into first person, but fictionalized and totally confected sort of thing.
As the story kept changing, did you find yourself having to cut out little flourishes that you'd come to love but which no longer belonged?
Oh, yes, and that is my great pleasure, actually, is cutting. I love to cut. And the better something is, the more I love to cut it, because it's almost a show of strength, which, of course, is of no interest to anyone but me. But really, to just subjugate everything to the final piece of writing is kind of thrilling in a way that I imagine a sporting event is.
I want to ask you to read the beginning of that first story that you wrote that you said is somewhat autobiographical and started off as maybe a journal and then ended up as a story. It's called Days Now.
Right, right. And let me try and find it here. Here it is. I had never known what I was like until I stopped smoking, by which time there was hell to pay for it. When the haze cleared over the charred landscape, the person I had always assumed to be behind the smoke was revealed to be a tinny weights and balances apparatus, rapidly disassembling on contact with oxygen. The first 2 weeks. I lie on the floor and howl with grief. A friend tells me, during the third week, it will occur to you that you're insane, and you'll think, well, now I'm insane. What difference does it make whether I smoke or not? This is a trick to get you to smoke. The third week. I'm insane, but I'm determined to wait it out. Today I bump into someone crossing the street. I begin an apology, but when he tells me to watch where I'm going, in a tone I consider unnecessarily condemning, I seize him by the lapels. For an instant we look at each other, then I release him back into the surge of pedestrians and continue on, stiff with fear. I have gained 20 pounds. I weep unstintingly for the victims of tragedy I see around me on subways, in restaurants, and on the street, but the victims look at me oddly and move away. I find that I have elaborate opinions about things I had never previously given a thought to, and that it is imperative that everyone within earshot understand exactly what I mean and why, in detail, I mean it. Everything makes me angry unless it makes me sad. I cannot tell how long anything takes. Spring. The smoke-free air is a flat, abrasive surface that I must inch my way along, but I'm subject to sudden seizures of pellucid hatred which impel me out the door during dinner or in the early hours of the morning, or, when I'm too helpless to move, into weak, furious storms of tears. Although I'm demanding and insatiable, everything I want is sucked dry of flavor and color and warmth by the time I get it, like packaged foods in an employee cafeteria. When I wake up in the morning, my jaws ache.
It's a great story. It's called Days, and this woman is nearly driven insane, I think, by by having given up smoking. Was your experience somewhat like that?
Oh, it was more than exactly like that.
Were you writing when you stopped smoking?
No,
obviously, because this is your first story.
Yes, and I think actually stopping smoking and starting writing had a great deal to do with each other.
It's interesting because most writers who smoke can't stop because they honestly believe that they will never be able to write another word if they don't have a cigarette.
I actually, not to encourage them in this idea, but smoking does seem to be lodged into the deepest aspects of one's character, and I think that really, if you stop smoking, you change.
How did you change? By writing?
Well, yes. I mean, in a way, I started to express myself in many ways that I never had before.
When you first started to write, was there anything that threatened to paralyze you that you really had to repress as much as possible or else it would overcome you and you'd have to stop?
Yeah, I'd say that is a constant battle, possibly for most writers, certainly for me, that I almost have to write with my eyes closed so that I don't see what I'm writing.
Why is that? Why can't... are you measuring it up against the great writers of our time?
Well, I would say that, sure, inevitably, but I would say even more that... You know, in a way, one of the things that I hope most to do when I'm writing is to make it look easy. But even as you can see, words do not fall from my lips in beautiful English cadences. They don't flow from my pen that way either. And really, a first draft of anything I do is appalling. It's just so horrible and so embarrassing. But if you don't get the first draft, you don't get the second draft, and then you don't get the third draft, and you don't get the 200th draft, and you don't get the final draft that looks simple and easy.
Did you tell friends that you were writing?
Oh, no. Only the man I live with, who is himself a writer. I didn't tell anyone, really, for a long, long time.
In the modern world, people are usually identified by what it is they do.
Uh-huh.
And if you're at a party, you are so-and-so who does such-and-such. And if friends introduce you, you're so-and-so who does such-and-such. What was it like for you before you were Deborah Eisenberg, writer, to be introduced as, this is Deborah Eisenberg, she's a waitress? Because the truth is that people's status in the world seems to always be measured by what it is they get paid to do.
That is certainly true here. And I really clung to the title of waitress with a ferocity that seems now a bit unnecessary, really. And actually, I think part of the reason I was so concerned that I'd be known as a waitress when I was introduced was that I of course, took a certain bitter pleasure in the reaction I would frequently get, which was that the turned back. And also, well, it was quite interesting to see always what people, how people would react. And, you know, I think people should not be rude to their waitress or their taxi driver or whatever, and as they aren't rude to their author.
Well, would people be less interested in you, though, once you proclaimed that you were a waitress?
Oh, very frequently. And then, of course, sometimes it was just considered to be this kind of fascinating and exotic, impossible piece of information, as if there was no such thing as a waitress. How could, I mean, we all know you're not a waitress. There are no waitresses.
Did you go through a period of begrudging your friends their success in the artistic world or anything because you didn't have an outlet like that for yourself?
Well, I would say when I was working as a secretary, which was a job that I was very bad at, with the best will in the world, I was a very, very bad secretary, and I found it extremely difficult, and I hated every moment of it. And at that time, as now, I knew a lot of actors, and I actually, as a group, I prefer actors probably to any other group of people in the world. But I did, you know, when we would all convene in an evening, and my friends would say, oh, we worked so hard today. You know, we did these sensory exercises. The floor was spinach. It was really great work. We worked very hard. And I would think, oh, you worked hard, huh? Yes, I would say that there was a strain of desperate jealousy.
My guest is writer Deborah Eisenberg, and her first collection of short stories has just been published by Knopf. It's called Transactions in a Foreign Currency. During the time you were becoming a writer, you were living with a writer, with Wallace Shawn, who is a playwright and has written a movie. Did you want to show him your work? Did you want, because it's very complicated, I think, when you're living with someone who does something like what you do, about how much you want to commiserate on that thing.
Yes, although also I would say that if I hadn't been living with a writer, or perhaps if I hadn't been living with this particular writer, I also wouldn't have dared write, and probably not dared to continue. And there have been times when I've been more or less dependent on showing him things. I've never shown anyone, including him, anything sort of at the beginning. Not till I'm really quite far along, according to me, in something. But it was terribly helpful at first when, you know, it was evident to me that I was not a writer and could not be a writer because I couldn't write. I simply couldn't get anything into English. And he said, well, of course you can't. He said, everybody writes like a five-legged pig at first, was his great phrase. And I think that that's true for most writers, and I think that only another experienced writer would have known that or had the generosity to let me in on that secret.
Did you want to try to take advantage of contacts that he might have that you might be able to use?
Well, I certainly would have, except that none of them really were very useful to me. I mean, really, now it's wonderful to know writers that he knows and to know all kinds of people that he knows. But it's, you know, when you're submitting things to be accepted, say, in a publication as I was, it really doesn't matter who you know at all because there's so many good writers and nobody cares who you know. They care how you write, I think. I mean, perhaps this is a self-serving view. And actually, to tell you the truth, that I found my publisher as a waitress. I was basically discovered in a bar.
How?
Well, I was working in this bar where I worked, and I would wait on this very nice couple from time to time. And the woman said, she kept saying to me, "Well, you're a writer, aren't you?" And I kept saying, "No, I'm a waitress." And she'd say, "No, no, you're a writer. I know you're a writer." And I'd say, "No, I'm a waitress." And it turned out she was a writer, and her name is Lori Colwin. I'm sure you are familiar with her writing. And then my play was done, and she said, "Aha, you see, you are a writer. Why don't you show me something that you've written?" So I did, and the next day, a friend of hers, who is now my editor at Knopf, called me. And that was how I got published initially.
That's a great story.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was just wonderful. I mean, I had stories in magazines between then and the time my book came out. But that was my first publishing contact, really.
My guest is writer Deborah Eisenberg, and her new book, Transactions in a Foreign Currency, has 7 of her short stories that's just been published by Knopf. Now, some people might have felt that they knew you or knew of you already through My Dinner with Andre before your book came out, because you're mentioned in there several times. Did that affect you at all when the movie came out and when more people felt this connection with you from having seen the movie? And so you were being seen basically through somebody else's eyes.
It was really quite nice because in a way it's the nicest role I think a woman has ever had in a movie, even though I wasn't exactly in the movie. It's a very honorable position, my position in that movie. And it was very gratifying, yeah.
There's one other passage I'm going to ask you to read, and that's it's a dream, basically, in that first story that you wrote that we were talking about that started off as a journal, and that's about someone who's giving up smoking. And this is from Transactions in a Foreign Currency. Do I have the page
yes.
on that?
Okay. Yes, you do.
I'd like you to read the dream, and I've had this dream, which is why I want you to read it.
I'm sorry. My dream. This is a dream I frequently have. I glance down at my hand, the posture I've denied it for so long, the gesture it has so often hopelessly initiated, is suddenly deliciously completed. I am holding a lit cigarette. I am now able, I reason in my dream, to display the scope of my will. I can either inhale from the cigarette in my hand or not, as I freely choose. I freely choose to inhale, and the fantasy instantly collapses. The entire mendacious simulacrum shivers and falls at my feet, leaving me, a slave who will have to smoke forever now, in the barren waking world where it is easy to recognize the dreadful thing I had briefly mistaken for choice. Then I wake truly, empty-handed in the merciful morning.
I've really had that dream, have you?
I really have. I'm just horrified to find out that are you an ex-smoker?
Yeah, I stopped around probably 7 years ago, and I have that dream, I'd say, between every 4 and 7 months.
Yes, I still have it. I don't know how frequently, but at the beginning I had it all the time, and I still have it.
I love the way you say that you confused it with choice, or however you put it.
Isn't that just the way it is, really, in that dream? You think, oh, well, you know, I don't have to do this any longer.
And you realize you're a slave.
Yeah.
Do people tell you that they recognize themselves in any of your stories? And if so, is that important? I mean,
I would be extremely pleased to hear such a thing. No one has said exactly that to me. They've said I recognize people that I know.
When we were setting up this interview, you told me on the phone that you used to be lazy, that you used to think you didn't want to do anything.
Right.
You were happy to not do anything.
I sure did think that. And I still am. I'm the laziest person you have ever met. I mean,
give me some proof.
Well, I really hate to do almost anything that would be considered work. Although I really quite, I mean, writing is too hard for me, it's too hard for me to do, but I don't consider it work Exactly. It's a sort of deep, difficult pleasure. But no, I mean, if I, as I may soon have to do, earn a living again, I just don't know what I'll do. I mean, I'd almost prefer to just lie on the street and, you know, with a tin cup. I really hate earning a living. And I don't like cross-country skiing, and I don't like cooking, and I don't like doing all kinds of things that people do.
As gratifying as writing seems to be to you, do you ever wish that you could stop thinking about sentences that were hanging you up? Or, you know, I mean, are you haunted now, although, you know, gratifying as it is? Are there times that you would really like to turn it off and forget about
the
whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, when I can't do anything very good, I mean, right now I'm just as stuck as anyone ever has been. And also, I don't ever know whether I'll ever be able to do anything again. And this could be the end. I mean, you may be talking to an ex-writer. but it's true that if... I mean, one other great thing that my boyfriend said to me when I was writing, you know, when I started, I said, well, how on earth can you think of, you know, that I would be able to write? I've never done anything in my whole life. I've never done anything useful, and I really can't do any kind of work, and I'm just totally useless. And he said, well, that's one of the wonderful things about being a writer, because when you're a writer, everything that you do can be considered work. But of course, now I'm coming to see the other side of the coin, which is that, in a way, everything you do can be considered work. And there's no time at which, you know, you can't sort of come home from the office and kick off your shoes and pour yourself a martini and turn on the TV, because there's no time at which life stops. And that's what you're doing, in a way, I think. I think what a writer is doing is sort of engaging in life, even if only inside four walls.
That was writer Deborah Eisenberg, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Deborah Eisenberg's first collection of short stories, Transactions in a Foreign Currency, is published by Knopf. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Paul Kerber and Audrey Voblaitis. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.